remains the least vaccinated continent against COVID-19. The move to dump vaccines in Africa is not only immoral, but also a violation of basic human rights. Experts say such behavior by the West is the weakest link in the fight against COVID-19. In a bid to stop this dumping, Kenya now says it will not accept vaccines with a shelf life of below 3 months.
We will not accept any donation whose expiry is less than 90 days. We are ideally looking for 120 days, which is 4 months, but will not accept anything below 90 days.
Why are Western countries engaging in what is clearly political showmanship of donating vaccines which are about to expire?
Western countries have always done that. It's just that COVID-19 is in the public eye because there's so much media coverage and everybody's invested in understanding what is going on in a system that has always existed that way. So I think to look at this, you have to put yourself in the shoes of Western countries, that if you're a Western country leader, you're a politician.
Now, the COVID-19 vaccine procurement facility led by the African Vaccine Procurement Trust, the African Center for Diseases Control and Prevention, and the WHO are calling for improvements in the quality of vaccines donated to Africa. Now, Dr. Chuktungi, how can these be achieved?
Now, what should be done to change course? Going back to my earlier point, I think you have to think about the long-term things, the medium-term things, and the short-term things. Now, the long-term, of course, is the, how do we shift this whole broken system of global health where there's such power imbalance, there's such, overwhelming influence by some countries over global health practice. And then what you call putting profits before people. Those are political choices that the residents and the populations in those Western countries have to make, where, for instance, they could, make political choices that favor politicians and governments and parties that put humanity above, profit. That's a much more long-term thing because it has to happen in more countries and, so that at least at the end of the day, the world, has a sort of a reset of its values.
Now, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says in order to tackle the current situation, developing countries need to manufacture their own vaccines. He made the remarks in January when he opened a new vaccine plant in Cape Town. Let's take a listen.
Africa should no longer go cap in hand to the Western world begging for vaccines that they just want to drip off from their tables. We will stand on our own.
Dr. Chuktungi, now what are the obstacles towards the manufacture of vaccines in Africa?
And yet the benefit extends beyond the individuals. So vaccines traditionally have been funded or financed as public goods, where globally there have been mechanisms which have been put in place to ensure that everybody everywhere can receive vaccines without having to think about the cost of those vaccines. And so when you have this kind of mechanism, it is not profitable for pharmaceutical companies to produce vaccines, because if they produce them and they went to market them and sell them the way they sell everything else, the market wouldn't exist. And so the system has been set up in such a way that vaccines being global public goods, they are financed in a very specific model. And therefore, Africa, without having already existing infrastructure before these funding models are put in place, wouldn't be competitive on the global market for producing vaccines and selling them. So there've been no prior investment in mass manufacture vaccines in Africa. But what the pandemic has shown us is that Africa is dispensable. African lives are dispensable. When push comes to shove, when every country is facing a pandemic, an outbreak within their borders, they'll prioritize their citizens. And so Africa, which has traditionally not had capacity, is the last on the list of priorities.
Iran is now a major manufacturer of COVID-19 vaccines. The Islamic Republic has developed vaccines such as Coviran Barakat and Postru Covac, which are now being used in the country's national vaccination drive. The Postru Covac vaccine has been successfully produced jointly by Iran and Cuba. Iran has expressed readiness to share its vaccine technology with other African and developing countries, which will certainly lead to self-sufficiency in vaccine production.
Historically, we know about some Western pharmaceutical companies such as Pfizer that used Africa to undertake illegal or unethical trial of drugs. Some African countries participated in the COVID-19 vaccine trials, but unfortunately, they were not prioritized in the on-time distribution of vaccines. Now, Dr. Choptungi, what is being done to decolonize the global health system?
The environment has improved, and the regulatory environment has improved for research. And so the narrative around guinea pigs, once in a while you get the occasional unethical practice, but it's not as prevalent as it was a few years ago. Now, having said that, I think the question is, based on what we know and our experience, for instance, with HIV/AIDS therapeutics, what kind of negotiations the countries which had vaccine trials happening within their borders, what kind of negotiations they had, and whether there was any special considerations to be sure that they get a certain allocation of vaccine doses once the trials were concluded. I'm not privy to that. And by all indications, those countries don't seem to be advantaged compared to other countries. And so it's possible that in spite of all the investment in strengthening the system, that still this was something that countries missed out in when they were negotiating or when they were accepting how their populations participate in this vaccine trial.
We are apparently short of time, but thanks a lot, Dr. Catherine Choptungi, for your insight. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall see how Djibouti has become a hub of imperialist aggression in Africa. Stay with us. Djibouti is a tiny Horn of Africa country located at the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb, which links the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden. Now, this country is considered of vital strategic importance, but despite its location, Djibouti remains poor and is now being used as a hub of United States-led imperialist powers that seek to spread their hegemony in Africa and beyond.
Successive regimes in Djibouti have clung to power by promoting their small country in the Horn of Africa as a vital tool for Western powers to use in the quest for their global dominance. While neo-colonial Western powers use Djibouti only as a military base, the country is benefiting from China's Belt and Road Initiative, a global infrastructure development strategy. The U.S. is now intent on misusing its presence in Djibouti to counter China, which established a military base in the country to safeguard world peace and development.
When I visited China for training in 2009-2010, there was a very big change because all areas of the military had been computerized and you had the advanced technologies in terms of satellite, in terms of computers, in terms of nuclear forces, which are purely defensive.
For analysis on how Djibouti is being misused by Western powers as a center of imperialist aggression, we contacted Abdurrahman Muhammad Ahmed, a Djiboutian political activist living in exile. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Now, how did Djibouti turn into a major base of U.S. militarization and imperialism in Africa?
We can say that actually the decision was not an idea that came from Djibouti or the political leaders of Djibouti at that moment, but it was always a long vision from the U.S. and especially the Western imperialist in camp to have this idea of controlling a major maritime road. So after the September 11, there has been a negotiation, and we know with fact today that discussion was facilitated by another vassal regime of U.S. imperialism, namely the Emirates, under the guise of actually helping Djibouti to develop its economy. So after September 11, that's when the U.S. decided to have a military base in Djibouti.
Last November, Djibouti hosted the U.S.-led Allied Appreciation Day, in which major U.S. allies, including Britain and France, showcased a variety of equipment that is part of their military operation. Military officials presented a variety of military capabilities and a military flyover. What was the motivation of Djibouti in approving such an event that could be viewed as a threat to China, which has a base in the country?
Djibouti became actually lost its sovereignty, so they accept silently any dictate for other benefits, such as actually kind of money, or actually by keeping that dictatorial regime in the loop of the Western countries. But for me, when they showcased their equipment, it was a message directed first of all to the rest of the African country, because today we know that they are losing their credibility, or what's left about their credibility. So they are still trying to say, we still have the best equipment and we are the best to defend you, which is not true.
By allowing aggressive military moves by Western armies on its soil, Djibouti could be turning itself into a power keg.
In 2018, there were military tensions between the United States and China in Djibouti. Now, in a provocative move, Pentagon claimed the Chinese lasers injured U.S. military pilots in Djibouti. China refuted the allegations, saying it was in complete contradiction to the facts.
I can tell you the Chinese side, having conducted serious checks, has already clearly told the U.S. side that their so-called criticisms totally do not accord with the facts.
Now, Mr. Ahmad, is there a likelihood of a military confrontation between China and the United States in Djibouti?
Yes, the possibility is very high. And already what we are witnessing is actually a kind of a Cold War confrontation. On another side, they're trying to actually tarnish the image of China, especially when it comes to Djibouti, because China actually facilitated a lot of project, infrastructure project, building the People Palace, building hospital, schools, stadium, roads.
The current Djibouti president, Ismail Omar Guelleh, has been in power for 22 years. April last year, he was re-elected for a fifth term as president with more than 98% of the vote after the election in a tiny country was boycotted by the main opposition. A citizen who spoke on the condition of anonymity for fear of reprisal by the country's dictatorship gives his reasons for not voting. During the elections, Guelleh faced just one challenger, political newcomer Zakaria Ismail Farah. This sole opposition candidate cast doubt on the transparency of the voting process, saying his delegates were ejected from polling stations. The US and other Western countries claim to advocate for democracy in the other African countries, but have ignored the dictatorship in Djibouti. This is another clear case of double standards.
Former president was more close to let's say the Western imperialism, and when he left power in 1999, he made sure that his nephew, the actual president, came to power. The actual president was at that moment not a political figure, but he made sure through a kind of a political coup to come to power. And since then, since 1999 up to today, it's more than actually 23 years, Ismail Omar Guelleh is still in power, and the Western allies are very happy with him and with his regime, because he's playing a crucial role for their interests, not only in Djibouti, but also in the region, and very specifically when it comes to Somalia.
Despite hosting Western military bases for decades, Djibouti is near the very bottom of the annual United Nations Human Development Index, ranking 166 out of 189. Now, Mr. Ahmad, what is the reason for this high level of poverty in Djibouti?
It's past 44 years of independence. Djibouti today is worse than when we get the independence. And the reason is actually, when it comes to imperialism, what they want is actually always to put in place a puppet regime, a stooge regime, that will keep or protect their interests, and only these few people will get short benefits, while the majority of the people will get rip off from the their land and their own opportunities. So yes, I'm not surprised, and actually this is what's going on.
Can you elaborate a little bit on why these imperialist powers are interested in seeing poverty and destitution in Djibouti?
The imperialistic vision, it's actually to control physically and military, to control all these strategic location and not allow actually any awakening from the people. And we know also that actually people who are living there are Muslim. So they don't want actually any Muslim countries cooperating, defending their interests, coming back and developing their people, who even might become an example for other countries and other people. And what's happening in Djibouti, it is the perfect study case for many people, specifically for the Muslim community, because and thank you for this opportunity of especially this discussion with Press TV, because today when it comes to Djibouti or Somalia or other Muslim country, Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, is demonized by the imperialist camp. But we know actually from our side that the Iranian people actually stood, refused to actually to be subjugated, and actually developed their country. But they don't want us to follow that example. They don't want us actually to tell that story. They're telling us a propaganda.
Well, thank you very much, Abdulrahman Muhammad Ahmad. It was a very interesting discussion, but unfortunately, our time is up for today. We shall definitely revisit the subject in future. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. And until our next episode, it's goodbye for now.
We congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
In the limelight.
Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, said recently that the Biden administration's views were negative about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline because it is seen as a geopolitical leverage which aims to divide Europe and undermine Europe's energy security. We're prepared for you an article written by Shervin Tahiri under the heading, Nord Stream 2 will divide Europe, entire West in half. Forget about the East and Western division of Europe. Nord Stream 2 pipeline will not only cut this continent, but the entire West into two halves. Perhaps we cannot say that all the current hype over the Ukraine crisis is an attempt to stop construction of this pipeline, which will give Moscow new leverage over the European Union. But one can say that stopping the Nord Stream 2 project is the main reason behind the current face-off between Washington and Moscow. American rulers, both Democrats and Republicans, are well aware that the economic logic of building this pipeline to transfer energy from natural gas fields in Russia's Yamal Peninsula near the Arctic Ocean to the northeastern coast of Germany in Greifswald via the Gulf of Finland and the Baltic Sea overshadows the military logic that seeks further extension of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization NATO towards the east. The former president of the United States, Donald Trump, said in a recent interview that the pipeline was one of the dumbest moves I've ever seen, and claimed that Germany would get over 70% of its energy from Russia. Donald Trump added, "And I'm the one that brought that up. Nobody ever knew about it. I used to talk about it all the time. Then they'd say, oh, he's weak on Russia. Putin would say, you're killing me with this pipeline, but I got it stopped." As Donald Trump said, his administration approved sanctions against companies involved in the construction of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, but the administration of his successor, Joe Biden, suspended them. However, in 2020, not only most Democrats at the U.S. Congress joined Republicans in passing those sanctions, but Joe Biden himself announced that Nord Stream 2 is a bad deal for Germany, Ukraine, and other U.S. allies in Eastern and Central Europe. Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, said last year that the Biden administration's views were negative about the pipeline because it is seen as a geopolitical leverage which aims to divide Europe and undermine Europe's energy security. The Biden administration, which had announced from the beginning that all companies involved in the project must withdraw as soon as possible, knew that imposition of serious sanctions against the pipeline must be avoided for a host of reasons. Finally, when Nord Stream 2 was completed in September, the White House decided to follow a multi-pronged policy to curb further development of Russia's energy policy in Europe. On the one hand, President Biden talked about getting along with this international and not simply Russian project, while on the other hand, he tried by stoking the crisis over Ukraine to threaten possible interests that Russia and its Eastern European allies could seek through development of this pipeline. By doing this, Joe Biden avoided the anger of his European allies who were fretting over increasing energy prices while shunning the possibility of facing the wrath of major British and European energy companies that were involved in the Nord Stream 2 project. As a result, the Republicans decided to turn a blind eye to the role played by the energy giant Halliburton in the construction of this pipeline. Construction of Nord Stream 2 ended in September, and it was ready to be launched in the coldest months of the year in order to prevent a steep rise in the European Union's energy prices. Afterwards, Nord Stream 2 AG, the Russian company behind the project, decided to register its affiliates in Germany in order to start the legal steps needed for the inauguration of the pipeline. However, the new coalition government in Germany, headed by Chancellor Olaf Scholz, has refrained from licensing the project under pressure from the United States, NATO, and Ukraine. As a result, the consumer price of natural gas has greatly increased across Europe. Many experts believe that Germany's doodling for licensing this project is a result of the weak diplomacy followed by the country's new foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, who is greatly bent towards the United States. The German government previously alleged that the Russian company, which is totally owned by the country's energy giant Gazprom, has registered its affiliates in Switzerland and not Germany. In recent days, This excuse has been taken from the German government, and the geopolitical war between Russia and the United States has become more evident amid Europe's energy crunch. It is evident that the new coalition government in Berlin has decided to act more cautiously amid the ongoing geopolitical war in Europe. As a result, it has made the inauguration of Nord Stream 2 conditional on Russia avoiding military operations in Ukraine. At the same time, this policy will enable Germany to expect Russia return its favor in the near future, when Moscow is going to turn into the biggest energy supplier and possibly biggest trading partner of Berlin. The government of Germany's former Chancellor Angela Merkel opposed the suspension of the Nord Stream 2 project until its last days in office, despite the fact that her party, the Christian Democratic Union or CDU, was more closer to Washington than the existing ruling party, the Social Democratic Party SPD. Faced with demands to go along with Donald Trump's sanctions against a number of major Russian, European and even American companies, Angela Merkel announced that Nord Stream 2 was a private sector project and that the German government would not interfere in its implementation. Of course, the US Democrats had hidden but more radical reasons to sanction companies involved in this project, because Nord Stream 2 was in every aspect similar to its predecessor, Nord Stream 1, which is the world's longest seabed gas transfer pipeline and was inaugurated back in 2011. Nord Stream 1 comprised of two parallel pipelines, 1,220 kilometers long and 1,220 millimeters in diameter, whose maximum annual capacity for gas supply from Russia to Europe was 55 billion cubic meters of natural gas. In the case of Nord Stream 1, only 30% of almost $15 billion investment in construction of land and seabed pipeline was made through stockholder companies, and the remaining 70% came from other sources. The lion's share of investment in Nord Stream 2 came through an international German banking network. Nord Stream AG is an international consortium of five major companies based in Zug, Switzerland, 51% of whose shares are owned by Russia's Gazprom. However, all its affairs are run from Gazprom headquarters in the northern district of St. Petersburg, Russia. Other oil and gas companies involved in the project include German, Dutch and French energy firms, as well as German, Russian, Japanese and Italian companies that specialize in laying pipelines on seabed. On the list of companies involved in this project, one can see major firms from Denmark, the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, Sweden, Spain, Norway, France, and Italy. This long list of major European energy firms involved in Nord Stream 2 project is enough to explain the confusion that the White House has been faced in its effort to prevent the completion of this international project. The US-based Halliburton and Intec Engineering are two major American energy corporations involved in the Nord Stream 2 project. Despite all the aforementioned facts, the Nord Stream 2 project is not actually new. Since the time of the former Soviet Union, that is, for more than half a century, Europe has been dependent on transfer of gas from Russia. Some experts even believe that the economic collapse of the Soviet Union was the result of a plot by then US President Ronald Reagan in the mid-1980s. Some 18 years ago, on 27th of February 2004, the Washington Post carried a report on the role of gas in the collapse of the Soviet Union and shed light on a plan by the US government to sabotage the eastward transfer of gas through the Soviet Union, Poland, and then East Germany to Western Europe. The report admitted that at the beginning of 1980s, Ronald Reagan put pressure on his Western European allies to prevent their participation in the construction of a gas pipeline from Russia, while at the same time drastically slashing West banking cooperation with Moscow. These sanctions prevented Eastern European countries from taking full advantage of their energy resources to revive their economies. The Kremlin and its allies were not only unable to pay for the Cold War expenses, but due to insufficiency of their economies, they totally relied on the revenues earned through selling and transferring natural gas to Western Europe. The Nord Stream 2 project, which is the most important energy project in Europe, has been designed to double the amount of gas that Russia sends to Germany and also bypass Ukraine as a traditional transit route for Russian gas, because it goes through the Baltic Sea. Since the pipeline deprives Ukraine of gas transit revenues and increases Europe's dependence on Russian natural gas, Moscow has been faced with increased resistance from the United States and inside the European Union at a time that Russia is in the midst of a serious face-off with the West.
Spotlight. Welcome to Spotlight. Israel has been using its vast support from the U.S. to find allies in the Middle East region. Days ago, Israeli President Isaac Herzog made his first visit to the UAE. The visit marks another step by the two sides to bolster ties despite concerns among regional countries. Well, Iran has raised the alarm about Israel's growing presence in the West Asian region, saying the regime poses a major threat to all regional countries. Bahrain also received the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, in an official two-day visit. Bahrain was one of the regional states that normalized its relations with the Israeli regime via the Washington-mediated so-called Abraham Accords back in August 2020. Ever since, the island has been witnessing near daily popular protests against the deals, whose opponents say opens up the way for the Israeli regime's interference in the Persian Gulf region.
Some Arab countries have had clandestine relations with Israel for many years, despite claiming support for Palestinians and calling for the liberation of the occupied territories. But recently, these relations have become increasingly overt, and it seems they have nothing to be afraid of anymore to rebuild their relations. In the latest developments, the Israeli regime's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, visited Manama on Thursday and met with Bahrain's king and other high-ranking officials. During the visit, the two sides signed a security cooperation agreement with Bahrain, the first such deal between Israel and a Persian Gulf Arab country. Gantz claims the agreement takes the bilateral relations to new heights and will contribute to the security of both Manama and Tel Aviv and the stability of the region.
It was not only a normal reception, but number one, it is the first time that any Gulf state has signed a defense agreement with the Zionists, with the occupiers of Palestine. Number two, that he was taken to all military establishments, especially the Americans, to boast of the military strength of the regime, that it can rely on the support of America and Israel.
Bahrain main opposition group Al-Wefaq slammed the move, saying any security or military agreement between the kingdom and Israel is unlawful and has no legitimacy. The group also blasted the visit by Gantz as crossing red lines. Analysts say not only political groups, but civil society groups in Bahrain consider Israel an enemy.
The people in Bahrain, with all their segments, whether opposition political societies that represent the popular majority, such as Al-Wefaq Society, and all civil society associations, consider Israel an enemy and reject any form of normalization with this enemy.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also strongly condemned the visit, saying the move emboldened the Israeli regime to commit more crimes. Israeli officials have made similar visits to a number of other Arab states, such as the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, and Morocco in the past couple of years to normalize ties with them. Bahrain, along with the UAE, normalized relations with Israel in 2020 under the so-called Abraham Accords through agreements brokered by the United States of America. Morocco and Sudan later signed similar U.S.-backed deals with the Israeli regime. Palestinians view the deals as a stab in their back and a betrayal of their cause of liberating their lands from Israel's decades-long occupation, leaving them with no other option but to rely on their resistance to free their territories and establish their own independent government.
Joining us on Spotlight, we have activist and political analyst Leif Maarouf, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels. Let's start off with Mr. Maarouf in the Lebanese capital. Sir, it's great to have you with us. More Persian Gulf Arab governments, they're expanding ties with the Israelis, but are these actions further putting the security of the region at risk?
Well, if you really look at these agreements, they're not going to change any much in the what's on the ground. This is Bahrain hosting the American Central Command fleet, the largest naval base basically for the United States in the most of the region, and if not the world outside the United States. And what are they going to bring with this treaty beyond open relations? These are relations that have been in existence between Bahrain and Qatar and the Emirates and the Saudis since the creation of the Zionist state in the closed doors, behind the closed doors, and they've financed against any revolutionary movements in the region, including the Arab Union movements led by Nasser or the liberation movements in Syria and Lebanon and so forth. So nothing's really going to change, but the fact that now the Bahraini's population is going to be used as gun fodder for the Israeli, the Zionist colony, because in the next war, if Bahrain is involved in a war against Iran on the side of the Zionist colony, it is Bahrain that's going to be decimated in such war and taking those beatings on behalf of the Zionists.
Elijah Magnier, how do you view the repercussions of intelligence and military cooperation between the Israeli regime and the likes of the Bahrainis and the UAE? Does this undermine and threaten the security of the region? Just to recall, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, recently told his Emirati counterpart that the presence of Israel in the region poses a threat to all regional countries.
Thank you for having me. I think since Israel joined the CENTCOM in Central Europe, the relationship between the Israeli military and the U.S. military has expanded and the bond is much stronger, which also justifies the relationship between the U.S. and all the Arab and Gulf countries. Therefore, Israel used to be an abusive entity against its own population and also plotting against Iran and the Axis of the Resistance and any other country that stands against the U.S. hegemony of the Middle East. And now what happens is the Israelis have more ground to stand on in Bahrain, in the Emirates, and not surprisingly in Saudi Arabia, and they used to have in Egypt and Jordan. So the Israelis are expanding their presence. However, this is not going to change a lot of the Israeli performance because there is already a rule of deterrence established between all the enemies of Israel and all the allies of Israel. I don't think there's much to be seen from the Israeli side in the future, apart from abusing of the wealth of the Gulf country, that are very happy to welcome the Israelis. And also, there is a lot of similarity between what the Israelis are doing and what the Gulf countries are doing, particularly Bahrain in this case. So I think the Bahraini can learn a bit more from the Israelis, not only about security, but about how the cruel conditions of the prisoners in Israel, because we have exactly the same condition in Bahrain that were condemned by the U.S. House Committee a few months ago, talking about the arbitrary detention, about political prisoner, about the restriction of freedom, all these inhuman conditions of people who oppose the Bahrain regime and ask for their freedom of expression. There's a lot of similarity of that in Israel against the Palestinians. So I think they complete each other.
Laith Maruf, let's not overlook the U.S.'s role in these normalization deals and the expansion of ties. What is Washington pursuing here, both in terms of the Israeli interests and in terms of its own regional motives?
Well, the Americans and before them the British were always trying to create, manufacture a good Arab, a good house Arab, that they can market to their population as acceptable. And at the same time, this is what finally the Gulf countries are trying to provide to the Americans, because for a long time these Gulf countries were providing also on behalf of American decision-making and CIA decisions the example of the bad Arab that was put in Hollywood, of the terrorists, of the Osama bin Ladens, of the Baghdadis, which is another service. So right now the Saudis and the Bahrainis and the Emiratis and the Qataris, what they are delivering to the American empire in value is that creation of this new propaganda that the good Arab is the one that accepts the rule of Zionist colonists and American hegemony over our land, over our holy lands, that the good Arab is the one that rules Mecca and Medina, the holiest cities of Islam, but allows the American to come into this land, or allows the Israelis to occupy Jerusalem. Obviously, when we talk about in Bahrain right now, the population of Bahrain is against this humiliation and defeat and subjugation of our people across the region. And that's true of all peoples of the Arab world. Much of them are not able to speak as openly as the people in Bahrain that are steadfast, that are out in the streets almost on a weekly basis, still, decade after the beginning of their rebellion against the Bahraini royal family. They're still coming out condemning this normalization with the Western colonizers on our lands.
Elijah Magnier, security assurances and guarantees have been highlighted as some of the motives behind these deals. Can these Arab countries rely on such promises from the U.S. and from the Israelis, and are these assurances viable in the long term?
Obviously, the Gulf countries, where there is no democracy, are trying to protect their kingdoms by relying on the Americans and trying to be friends with the Israelis, thinking that Israel can support them with the Americans and can help protecting their regime by offering new intelligence and new technology that can help the Gulf regimes to control and tighten the own citizens. So what we see is, what I understand from all of that, is a very fragile regimes who are trying to get more support from, more technological support, and more support from Israel, the friend of the United States, to protect this fragile regime because they don't think the lack of democracy at home can protect them enough, notwithstanding all the decades of ruling over a population that so far accepted the family to succeed one after the other, to pass on the power from father to son. And now, if the United States is talking about democracy and is saying that we are supporting the Gulf regime, this is a very clear contradiction with the principle of democracy in the West. Therefore, this regime can't hold unless they rely on illegal activity, on human rights abuses, on torture, and also learn from the Americans the lack of accountability. That is exactly what the Israelis also are doing and enjoying from whenever they wage war against all the neighboring countries. So I think there is a lot of fear behind that. That's why when we see the intelligence cooperation between the Gulf country and Israel, for what reason these Gulf countries are going to use it but against their own citizens.
Mr. Magni, I'm going to stay with you for a minute because our guest in Beirut just mentioned in his previous comments Bahrain as being one of the regional states that normalized its relations with Israel via the Washington-mediated deals back in August 2000. Ever since, the island has been witnessing near daily protests against the deal, with the protesters believing that such deals open up the way for the Israeli regime's interference in the Persian Gulf region. A lot of opposition from the people of these Gulf countries. Have these governments taken into consideration that these deals and pacts could actually backfire?
I don't think so, because the relationship with Israel is not new, as your guest rightly said. And this relationship goes back a decade with the Emirati, with the Qatar, and with the Bahraini monarchy. Therefore, I don't think the Israelis can offer more than the folkloric handshaking and pictures in front of the world just to show that Israel is accepted by all these Arab regimes, while the enemy and the demonized country that is completely isolated today is Iran, that is refusing to accept the reality. So nothing is going to change, because the animosity between Iran and Israel is very obvious and it is public. Iran is supporting the axis of the resistance that is creating much more pain to Israel than the outcome and the benefit that is getting from the Arab state for its own security. So the only thing that the Israeli can get from the Gulf country is business deal and more money to be injected in Israel and boost whoever is going to be the prime minister of Israel. On the security level, yes, they can monitor more the communication, they can cause more havoc to these countries and the group that are against the Israeli. They can easily infiltrate, like example, Syria or Lebanon or Iraq, because they are Arabs and their access is more open than the access to of the Israelis to these countries. And that will not change, because already these countries were working for the Americans on the intelligence service level, and the Americans supporting the Israelis because they are very close allies. So I don't think a lot is going to be manifested out of this memorandum of agreement and the security exchange and support from Israel to Bahrain or the Emiratis or Qatar or the Saudi Arabia.
Laith Matif, what about the stance that these Gulf countries are presenting to the Palestinians? Do you believe that these Arab governments have turned a blind eye effectively to the suffering of their Arab brethren?
Well, they've turned a blind eye since the beginning. I mean, we're talking about these monarchies have been installed by the British crown before they left in the 1960s and 70s. When we talk about Bahrain, this is a ruling family that is not even from Bahrain. Similarly for Qatar, similarly for the United Arab Emirates, they are from Knesset, and they were installed as agents to stop any revolutionary movements in the region. Because if you remember the 60s and 50s, and in the whole Arab world was decolonization revolutions, and the British rushed and installed these illegitimate and not indigenous monarchs over these Gulf countries to enforce continuous subjugation of the region and its resources. And so right now, when we look at what is the benefit for the Zionist colony and or the Americans, beyond just the media propaganda benefit for this move, it actually is a negative for the colonial project of Israel, because for 60, 70 years, these countries have been pretending to somehow care for the Palestinian cause, just so not to be a target of revolutionary activities against them in their land. And now they've burned their card, these Gulf monarchs, by stripping down naked in front of the Arab people as agents of destruction of the region on behalf of the Zionist colonists and the imperialists. They are now open to all attacks. There's nothing anymore that gives them legitimacy to stay.
All right, we're running short of time. One last question for Mr. Magnier. In the wake of these normalization deals, all Palestinian factions have been adamant that they will continue on with their resistance. Do you expect to see a more united Palestinian front in the face of these measures?
If President Mahmoud Abbas is removed from the presidency that he's holding for the last 15, 16 years, I think the Palestinians have shown solidarity against Israel and the will to fight back, to get back their land that has been stolen by the Israelis. Yes, we saw in the Sword of Jerusalem in the last fight how all of Palestine stood as one unity against the Israelis, and not only Jerusalem and Gaza, but that involves all the territory occupied since 1948. Yes, there is more unity among the Palestinians, more unity that is expressed by the Gulf countries with Israel is reflecting on more unity among the Palestinian groups willing to fight Israel and the axis of the resistance to hold on to this cause.
Very well. We're going to leave it there. Allow me to thank my guest, activist and political analyst, Leif Maarouf, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and journalist and political analyst, Elijah Magnier, speaking to us from Brussels. Also, thanks to our viewers for staying with us on tonight's